This Sunday, I took a nature walk. I recycle. And by the way, just to show you how environmentally conscious we are leaving this arena in a Prius.
I am the Solo Monster.
Is that man not great or what? I mean, how can anybody in their right mind dislike Daniel Bryan? It's just inconceivable to me. This is episode 205 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, February 12th, 2012. Happy early Valentine's Day to all of our female listeners out there. Want to lead up the show this week with some positive news. The Sound Off salute for this week goes to one Chris Hero, who finally signed his WWE developmental deal and started this week in Florida Championship Wrestling. At long last, Chris Hero is officially in FCW. The plan right now is to not make him a tag team with Claudio Castagnoli, who of course is now known as Mr. Antonio Cesaro down in FCW. I think they have singles pushes in mind for both guys. No word yet on what Chris Hero's new name is, at least I haven't heard. Obviously, it will not be Chris Hero. And my fingers are crossed, my fingers and toes are crossed for this poor guy. Let's just hope that he gets a name equally as good as his partner. And nothing wrong with Antonio Cesaro. I think that's a fine name, so hopefully they'll come up with something just as decent for Mr. Hero. As far as why his signing was delayed for so long, there was a lot of speculation about whether it was some sort of health issue, issue with his medicals. In fact, it was tied to that, and I think I might have actually reported here on the Sound Off way back when that there was at least a rumor going around that may have had something to do with elevated testosterone levels. And in fact, it did have something to do with elevated testosterone levels. Apparently, he has naturally elevated levels of that in his system, and it was causing issues. So it was not caused by any sort of drug or you know, steroid or something bad that he was on. It was something naturally producing in his body, and they had to address that and determine that it was, in fact, natural. It's not something he can help. And so that's been worked out, and he is officially down in Florida. So how long it'll be before we see him on TV, I don't know. You look at a guy like him, you look at a guy like Claudio, and there's a couple of, I mean, for God's sake, Tyler Black, who, of course, is Seth Rollins down in Florida. He's been ready for ages. And you've got Dean Ambrose and guys like Husky Harris who are still down there, Richie Steamboat. When you really look at the nucleus of people they have down there in Florida right now, it actually is pretty damn impressive, I have to say. They've got a lot of good guys down there. And I've said before, Dean Ambrose to me is the first guy that I think will be brought up to TV, probably not long after WrestleMania. That's at least my belief. The guy is that good. He can be on TV tomorrow, I think, and make an impact. But I can't wait to see all of these guys on television, quite frankly. And the chances that every single one of them are going to be brought up and given, you know, a proper push and not be saddled with some crappy character, I mean, the chances are slim that they're all going to be so lucky. But even if two or three of these guys hit it really big, that's going to make a really big difference, I think, on the product that we see on TV every week. We need guys like this on the main roster. We need fresh blood. And for those of you who are not familiar with Chris Hero's work, you can check him out on YouTube. He's been in Ring of Honor. He's competed in Combat Zone Wrestling and Independence all over the country. He has improved tremendously in the last few years. And I have nothing but high expectations for him and his former tag team partner. Although if they wanted to put the two of them back together as a team, I would have absolutely no problem with that either. They were a damn good tag team, the Kings of Wrestling were, in Ring of Honor. And you know, there's nothing wrong with bringing them in as a tag team at a time when WWE is in dire need of legitimate tag teams, and eventually they break off and they go off on their own in singles. I don't see anything wrong with that, but as of right now, that does not appear to be the plan. So that was the update on Chris Hero. I wanted to get that out of the way first. He is finally free and on his way, hopefully, to bigger and better things in the near future. Now, let's move on to Monday Night Raw from last week. It was the first Raw after what I thought was an excellent show the week prior. And in my opinion, Raw this week, a step down from last week's effort. I know this because unlike that show the previous week, which kept my attention throughout the entire 2 hours, I started to fall asleep during the second hour of Raw this week. That actually hasn't happened in a while. But yeah, I started dozing off. I thought the show did a good job of advancing some stories for WrestleMania. Obviously, the Triple H Undertaker stuff, the CM Punk Chris Jericho feud, which is now official for those of you who still doubted whether or not they were actually going to go with that. But it just felt like they filled this show with way too many video packages. It seemed like they were just trying to kill time. And, I mean, was it really necessary to air that Undertaker promo video twice on the same show? It was an awesome video, don't get me wrong, but there was no reason to show that thing twice in its entirety on the same program. It just felt like they were trying to fill time, and it just made for a boring show at many points, in my opinion. Now, apparently the reason there were so many videos this week is because they were heading over to Abu Dhabi this week. They just completed a pretty successful tour of Abu Dhabi, and it was going to be a pretty grueling schedule, so they didn't want to tax the guys, I guess, too much on TV and put together a show with all these different matches and stuff. So, you know, if that's the rationale behind it, I can't complain too much. But then again, if they were so concerned about their talent, I wish they would have let Mark Henry heal up his groin injury instead of allowing him to continue wrestling and injuring his knee, even if that was a Mark Henry call. The reason that he's out right now, and I think he'll be back in time for WrestleMania, I don't think he would allow himself to stay out and miss WrestleMania. And it would be a shame, too, quite frankly, for him to miss out on that after the year he's had. But even if it was a call that Mark Henry made, being some sort of tough guy, you know, I'm going to tough it out, you know, it's WWE's call to say, listen, you know, you're one of our top hands right now. We need you healthy. We're going to keep you out until you feel better. You know, it's the same thing with Ted DiBiase. I think he fractured his wrist or broke his wrist recently, and he's wrestling with a cast on his wrist. You know, WWE can ill afford to lose more guys to injuries, and it's not like DiBiase is exactly lighting the world on fire. They're not exactly giving him a big push, but I wish they would do a better job of taking care of that their talent in that respect as well. So let's move on to the show here. No good, bad, and ugly this week. Just kind of a mishmash of random thoughts on the more important key parts of the show to me. The other reason I dislike this show, by the way, no Funkasaurus on Raw this week. That is a fail. My man Brodus was nowhere to be found. I hope his mama is okay. For all the weeks for him not to be on this show, his dancing would have actually done a good job of jolting me awake during parts of this show. So let's move on here. We'll start with the top of the show. The show started with a long Triple H promo, which are four words that still send shivers up my spine all these years later. I see everyone creaming their pants over what a great promo Triple H cut here. Yeah, he did a good job of explaining his rationale behind not accepting a rematch with The Undertaker, but I really didn't think this was anything special. You know, I've seen the man cut a million promos like this one before. Part of the problem also was, I think, how bored the fans seemed to be with his interview. In fairness, I mean, this was a problem throughout the entire show. I thought this crowd sucked last Monday. So that was not necessarily Triple H's fault, but you know, a lively crowd who reacted when they were supposed to react always helps these segments out. That did not happen here. So, after informing us that the board of directors would be deciding the fate of John Laurinaitis and then talking about how much he respects The Undertaker and therefore he will not fight him again, The Undertaker interrupts Triple H. Triple H goes to leave. All of a sudden, his music stops and Triple H doesn't know what to do with himself because, you know, I guess he needs music to leave. And Undertaker interrupts with a video promo of his own, sort of. Let's talk about this for a moment here, because the creepiest thing to me on this show was Undertaker's bizarre obsession with Triple H. He appeared to be sitting in his, I guess, his understudy. You know, get it? Understand? Anyway. He was watching their match from WrestleMania last year on a loop, seemingly. He was talking about how, it's not over, it's not over. And he gave me this really creepy ex-boyfriend vibe, like he got dumped a year ago and still hasn't gotten over it. You know, with Triple H turning down his offer for a rematch, I kind of half expect Undertaker to come out on Raw this week and say, if I can't have you, no one can. And then blow his brains out right then and there. What a swerve that would be. I bet Vince Russo was pissed I thought of that before he did. Anyway, I did think this was a pretty cool little segment until they replayed it a second time later in the show, and by then I was just irritated by all of the video packages. Aside from a segment that was taped last week that they showed this week with NASCAR driver Carl Edwards, John Cena was nowhere to be found on the show this week, And that is a positive. I mean, he may be the face of WWE, but that also makes him the most overexposed face in WWE. So leaving him off the show from time to time will only make his future appearances more effective. And let's be honest, once he beats Kane at Elimination Chamber, probably with a little help from Zack Ryder, I'm guessing, we know we're going to see Cena back on TV every single week, and maybe even on SmackDown, too, talking about how The Rock finally decided to show up on TV again, because, you know, that's all the material that John Cena is given. Big Show and Daniel Bryan had another match. This time AJ was back in the champ's corner, almost got killed by Big Show again, but this time he stopped short, which, according to Daniel Bryan, is proof positive that Big Show meant to barrel over AJ the last time because he could have stopped himself. This was fine for what it is. You heard the audio I played at the start of the show. Daniel Bryan was even greater on SmackDown this week. Had a good match with Randy Orton. Kind of a shame they wasted their first match on TV. I mean, they still may end up in a match together at WrestleMania, maybe if Sheamus is in there. Make it a triple threat. If Mark Henry could come back, make it a Fatal 4-Way or something. I'm not a big fan of triple threats or Fatal 4-Ways for the world title at WrestleMania, but, you know, you got another championship match anyway. Singles match between Punk and Jericho, and you've got Rock and Cena as the real main event. So, you know, if ever there was a year they could get away with putting three or four guys in a title match at Mania, this would be it. I guess we'll see what they decide to do. But Daniel Bryan was great on SmackDown this week. If you missed it, you got to go back and check it out. Chris Jericho finally had his coming out party on Raw this week. He basically is playing the same heel character he was playing before, which is fine, but so much for reinventing yourself. He admitted that he was trolling the fans, which I believe is the same thing I said he was doing when there were people who actually debated me at the time when Jericho first came back, and they said, you know, oh, he's not trolling the fans. It's, you know, they gave all these different explanations for what Jericho was actually doing and where this story was going. Nope, he was just trolling the fans. And he said that everybody in the dressing room was nothing more than a Chris Jericho wannabe, none worse than CM Punk, the reigning WWE champion. Out comes Punk to confront Jericho, and instead of speaking, he chooses to remain silent. So, in fact, he is indeed being a wannabe Chris Jericho. He's copying his new gimmick. And then Punk walks away. I like this because it's about the title, you know, as it should be. It makes the championship feel important. Plus, the two of them are going to have a kick-ass match at WrestleMania, and they're going to try to steal the show, no doubt. So I'm totally fine with that. I would not be shocked at all if, with his victory in the main event, earning him the right to enter the chamber last at the pay-per-view next weekend, if Chris Jericho actually wins the title next weekend at Elimination Chamber, and then Punk goes into Mania as the challenger. I mean, that's really the better dynamic anyway, having the babyface chase the heel for the title. But I guess we'll see what they end up doing. Randy Orton and the Great Khali, yes, the Great Khali, beat Cody Rhodes and Wade Barrett. Not only did Randy Orton and the Great Khali beat Cody Rhodes, the reigning Intercontinental Champion, and Wade Barrett, somebody who I believe Booker T on SmackDown either this week or last week referred to as a future Hall of Famer. Great Khali was the one who actually beat Cody Rhodes. He beat him with a brain chop, which I find fucking revolting. This was the first point on Raw Monday night that I started dozing off was during this match, and I just could not be bothered to go back and watch it. I understand that Orton ended up laying out Khali after the match with an RKO to get over the fact that it's every man for himself in the chamber match. But again, the fact that Khali, you know, pinned Rhodes with a brain chop is just, it's just ridiculous. Tamina, Alicia Fox, Eve Torres, and Kelly Kelly beat Beth Phoenix, Natalya, and the Bella Twins in an 8-Diva tag team match. Tamina won with a superfly splash on Nikki, or Brie, who really cares. It's nice to see Tamina get picked to be the latest Diva flavor of the month, although I do hope she doesn't get her title shot at WrestleMania. No offense to her, but I'd rather see that spot go to Natalya, who seems to be teasing a feud with Beth, or, you know, if Natalya is too busy farting, I'd like to see Karma in that spot, you know? Beth apparently broke Eve's nose on a clothesline spot in this match. You could tell something went wrong when the referee put up the dreaded X sign and then he put his latex gloves on, which usually means that there's blood. I wouldn't mind if Beth actually made this her new gimmick and broke a different Diva's nose every single week. Might toughen them up a bit. Plus, they're used to the plastic surgery anyway. Johnny Ace graced my TV screen, which I was very happy to see. I just assumed he was still in Connecticut schmoozing the board of directors, but there he was. He announced that Shawn Michaels would be on Raw next week and that John Cena would battle Kane at the Elimination Chamber in an ambulance match. That's good news for Kane, I guess, since I believe he is undefeated in ambulance matches, having beat Shane McMahon in one at the Survivor Series back in 2003. Maybe Kane will take a pair of jumper cables to Cena's balls, just like he did to Shane during their feud. I'm going to call it now. Zack Ryder is going to jump out of that ambulance at some point during that match and attack Kane. You heard it here first. Main event of Raw Monday was the six-pack challenge. I can't remember them referring to a match as a six-pack challenge since the Unforgiven pay-per-view in 1999. I mean, I'm sure they must have had one since then. But when I heard six-pack challenge, I immediately thought of the very first one back at that Unforgiven pay-per-view over a decade ago already. God, I feel old. Anyway, this one featured all of the participants in the Raw Elimination Chamber match, which is just really dumb. I mean, you want people to pay money to see these six guys on pay-per-view. Now, granted, it's really all about the chamber gimmick. But still, you put these same six guys in the ring for free on TV? I mean, why not just do that beat-the-clock gimmick that they sometimes use, and, you know, whoever wins their match in the fastest time gets to enter the chamber last? I mean, there's no reason Punk and Jericho should have been in the ring at the same time here, whether they touched or not. I bet R-Truth would have preferred my idea to this match, given what happened to him on the show. Believe it or not, despite being very sore, R-Truth was actually okay coming out of that botched spot on the show. He was legitimately pulled from the match by management. He smacked the back of his head on the floor outside during a flip dive where Miz failed to catch him or really provide any sort of soft landing at all. And there was a ton of heat on Miz backstage after Raw, especially from Triple H, who apparently tore into him in front of everybody. You know, watching that whole thing unfold on Monday just made me angry. Really did. I mean, I admit, I've been busting the guy's balls a lot this week, like a lot of other people. You know, it's easy to pile on. I'm sure Miz did not do what he did on purpose. Mistakes happen. Could have easily happened to you or me. I mean, you don't know how you're going to react in the heat of the moment. All I know is that when I watched that, what pissed me off so much about it was that it wasn't as though they were doing a move sequence and somebody botched it up and it just looked really bad on TV. You know, this was negligence that could have resulted in real bad times for R-Truth. You know, that's why he got chewed out by Triple H backstage. It's not me overreacting and you know, poor Miz. I mean, again, mistakes do happen. I almost feel bad for the guy, but you know, there's a reason that when he walked to the back, he got yelled at. You don't get chewed out because you messed up a simple move. People fuck up all the time. You get chewed out if you are perceived as slacking off or trying to be lazy out there, for not protecting the person that's putting his well-being in your hands. I mean, I'm guessing that's where Miz's second botch came from when he took that phantom clothesline from Chris Jericho later in the match. I assume it came from him probably feeling bad about what happened earlier. He just was all, you know, his mind wasn't in the right place. Whatever it was, the dude had a bad night on Monday, but boy, when it's perceived that you're not doing enough out there to protect the person that you're in the ring with, that is a bad reputation to have. And even Alberto Del Rio got on the I Hate Miz bandwagon this week. He was on a radio station promoting his return. He actually did make his return this weekend on the West Coast at one of the house shows. And he was on this radio station. This is what Del Rio said. I'm gonna quote him on this. He said, "I hate The Miz. This is not part of the show. I really dislike that guy. I've tried to punch him in the face several times. Not in the ring. I mean outside the ring. He's like a little girl. He's always running from me. There's a big difference between The Miz and I. I am a real athlete. He is just a loud, stupid little kid. He's one of those guys who was probably bullied when he was in school. And that's the reason now that he's so loud and he wants attention from everybody." That's what Alberto Del Rio said. I like to imagine him saying this with his accent. I haven't listened to the audio. I know the audio is actually out there. All I did was read the comments, but as I read them the first time, I actually pictured him reciting this in his accent. That makes it even better. But wow. I still think that these are worked comments. That's just my interpretation. I know he said this was a shoot. I still think they're worked. I mean, especially the part where he said he's tried to punch him in the face outside the ring. But if I'm Miz, after the week I've had, I might want to ask Cody Rhodes if he still has any of those paper bags left that he can wear for a while. Jeez. I almost feel sorry for the guy. Almost. Back to the match. Not much else to really talk about. I mean, the botches by Miz left a bad taste in my mouth. I will say this, though. How awesome was that sell job on the GTS by Dolph Ziggler at the end? I mean, that man could sell ice to an Eskimo. He is awesome. Friday actually marked 9 years to the day that We lost Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig. It's the anniversary of his death. He died at the age of 44, and a lot of people, myself included, often make comparisons between Perfect and Ziggler and how great both men are, or were, at taking bumps. Ziggler really does remind me a lot of Hennig in that respect, and that's a good thing. That is a positive comparison to make there. Mr. Perfect was a great worker. He had great matches. But I remember specifically his bump taking. A lot of times it was way over the top. I mean, he would take a headfirst bump into the top turnbuckle and then do a flip. You know, I mean, it's completely over the top, but it was great. And Ziggler reminds me a lot of him in that respect. And that's one of the reasons I think I like Dolph so much. As I mentioned earlier, Jericho won the match. He gets to enter the chamber last at the pay-per-view, making him the odds-on favorite to win the title. I thought the show was over at this point until I heard this loud shrieking. I mean, honestly, it sounded like some woman was being raped in the audience. And thankfully, that was not happening. But unfortunately, the cameras cut backstage to a segment showing Eve, which was obviously taped before her broken nose, screaming in terror, being confronted by Kane. Kane said that for the first time in his life, he was scared of himself. And I think what he meant by that was that with this storyline, he finally realizes that he is a magnet for terrible storylines, and he is therefore afraid of himself. At least that's how I choose to interpret this this segment. Frank on Facebook pointed out something interesting that I didn't think of, and quite frankly, I would not put it past WWE, even though it makes no sense. In the Bible, and I am no expert here on the Bible, so correct me if I'm wrong, but in the Bible, Eve was the mother of Cain. And Frank said that he would not be surprised if WWE does a story where Eve ends up being Cain's mother. See, that would mean that Eve is also Undertaker's mother, since it was Undertaker's mother who bumped uglies with Paul Bearer. And wow, what a visual that is, Eve and Paul Bearer. I'd rather they do something where they reveal that Eve is actually Kane and Undertaker's sister, you know, thus fulfilling my storyline idea that I've talked about before on this show, about bringing in a sister of destruction. I always thought that could have worked with the right person in the role. For whatever reason, I had always pictured somebody like Daphne, somebody with like a goth gimmick in that role as the, you know, the younger sister of Kane and The Undertaker. I really think at one point in time, by now it's too late, but at one point in time, that could have worked. And it could have worked with Eve. I mean, I guess it wouldn't have made much sense since Eve is not even of the same ethnicity. But, you know, Eve is a tough girl. You know, she practices, I don't know if it's jiu-jitsu that she does or what she does, but she can fight. You know, she can handle herself. And, again, I wouldn't put it past WWE to come up with some stupid idea like that, but hopefully they won't listen to this show. Anyway, that was a terrible way to end Raw Monday night. I won't say their momentum on the road to WrestleMania stalled, but the car hit a nice big pothole this week. They need to be careful going forward because next time they may bust an axle, and that is a bitch to get fixed. So that's how I would sum up Raw for Monday night. One quick follow-up note on this show. Again, John Laurinaitis' fate was being put in the hands of the board of directors as to whether or not he would remain as the interim general manager of Raw. And they said, you got to go to WWE.com on Tuesday morning. They were going to make their decision. So they wanted to drive some web traffic, which is down quite a bit of late on the website. And in fact, the board of directors decided that John Laurinaitis, the executive vice president of talent relations, will stay as the interim general manager of Raw for the foreseeable future. I give a thumbs up to that decision. Johnny is one of the bright spots on this show each week. So he will remain the Raw GM for the foreseeable future. Now, I did watch more wrestling this week. I did watch parts of SmackDown, obviously, but I actually watched my first full episode of Impact in I don't even know how long. I had heard a lot of good things about last week's show from the UK, and I wanted to make time to watch this week's second UK taping. This was the second and final show that had been taped at the, I think, Wembley Arena in London is where it took place. And so I watched the show. I actually did some live blogging on Twitter during the show as well on Thursday night. Another great reason to follow me on there if you aren't already. Cheap plug. And overall, I thought this show was very good. In fact, I will say that it was a better pro wrestling show than Raw was this week. And I enjoyed Impact more than I did Raw. You know, Raw this week, again, we went over the reasons why there were so many video packages and they were going to Abu Dhabi and you're heading into WrestleMania and they do excellent video packages and they want to build up their key matches, but sometimes they go a little too far with it. and you're watching a two-hour show, you want to see action, and I just feel we didn't get enough action on Raw Monday night. But from a pro wrestling perspective, not that everything was perfect, but we had a lot of really good matches on Impact. Nothing really pissed me off too much. Everything seemed to make sense. They were promoting their Against All Odds pay-per-view, and which actually is taking place this weekend. Unfortunately, it's a pay-per-view that no more than 8,000 people will see, so it's kind of pointless. They're building up an event that very few people are going to care enough to purchase. But as a show, between what I saw with the matches, between the atmosphere, I mean, the atmosphere was great. You watch Impact from the UK, and it really looks like a big-time wrestling show. You know, I think they had a legitimate 6,000 or 7,000 people in there, one of the biggest TNA crowds they've ever had. They were a boisterous crowd, and it just looked really professional. You know, it was not amateur hour. It was not, oh, look at this, we have 900 people in the Impact Zone, and they don't give a fuck. These were people that were excited to be there for TNA, and they really did a fine job of making the show feel special. I got to give them a lot of credit for that. Couple of observations from the show. Bully Ray came out full of piss and vinegar this week. He was really pissed off with Bobby Roode. And it struck me during the course of this show, through even the segments with Bully later on during Impact, Bully Ray, the transformation from a tag team wrestler who appeared to already be beyond the peak of his career into what he has become as a single star is amazing. I mean, Bully Ray is tremendous in this role, and there's no real surprise that WWE, you may have remembered that report from many weeks ago, that you know there were certain names from TNA that WWE was interested in possibly picking up at the end of their contract, and Bully Ray was among those people. You know, not necessarily D-Von, and not even Samoa Joe piqued WWE's interest, but Bully Ray is somebody that they have their eye on, and there's a reason for it, because he is tremendous in this role. I don't know that the Bully Ray character would be as good in a PG environment as it is on Impact. But the guy is a tremendous talker. He always was, going back to the ECW days. And, you know, admittedly, it's a lot easier when you can go out there and you can curse people out. I mean, if you go back and look at some of, you know, Bully Ray's material and some of the things he did and confronting the fans and stuff in the original ECW, I mean, it's talking about hardcore shit. That's not the sort of thing you can do on television. But even in his current role, he doesn't have to go around cursing people out. He's great. And so that was one of the things that really struck me on the show. The other thing also that struck me, one of the few things that I absolutely hated about the show, and this was not TNA's fault, this goes squarely on the shoulders of the fans in the UK. I'm looking at you. And we have a lot of UK people who listen to this podcast. So if you were among the people in the audience at Wembley for Impact, and you were among the people chanting "What?" at Bobby Roode and Bully Ray during the opening segment, shame on you. I understand that it can be contagious. You're in the audience, and it's a fun thing to do when you're there live. You don't really give too much thought to how it's going to come across on television. It came across terrible on television. I could not believe the "What?" chants on the show. It was worse than any WWE show in recent weeks. I mean, this chant has traveled. It's like a virus, you know? It's like a virus that's airborne, and it travels from one organization to the other. And it almost ruined the opening segment for me. You know, these guys are having a verbal confrontation back and forth, and all I hear are these fans chanting, "What? What? What?" And it just so fucking annoying. I mean, again, that one chant is one of the worst things, I've said it before, to happen to the wrestling industry. As fun as it may be to be in the building and chant it, as a viewer watching it on TV, it absolutely sucks. So I was very disappointed in my friends across the Atlantic for this. I thought only dumb Americans chanted "What?", but apparently it's traveled. It's now international, unfortunately. AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels had a nice little match. I think it went about 5 or 6 minutes. I mean, obviously we've seen far better matches between the two of them before. Far, far better matches. But you know, for the time they were given, this was fine. One comment I made actually on Twitter during the show, there was a spot here where AJ Styles actually did a running flip dive onto Christopher Daniels on the outside, and of all weeks, the only comment that I could think to make was, I hope Miz was watching this. That is how you protect your opponent without killing him. Story of this match was really centered around Kazarian. I guess they're doing the storyline where Kazarian is some sort of slave. He is subservient for whatever reason, we do not know, to Christopher Daniels. And so, therefore, he assisted Daniels in beating AJ. He passed along what appeared to be brass knuckles, which factored into the fuck finish here, and it advances whatever storyline they are doing. But again, yeah, the action here was fine. Magnus and Samoa Joe came out to do a promo, more so Magnus than Joe. Magnus did most of the talking. He actually really impressed me here. I've seen some of Magnus on the Ring Ka King shows as well. And he is somebody who is very impressive. And you look at the guy, you know, he's got a good look. He seems young enough. I don't know how old he is. He might still be in his 20s. And from what I understand, he's improving in the ring. I mean, this is also a guy that if I'm WWE, and I don't know that they do or not, but they should have their eyes on him as well. I believe he comes from the UK, so obviously even though he's a heel, he and Joe were over big time with the audience here at Wembley Arena. And like I said, Magnus did a hell of a promo, and watching Joe and him together, I'm just happy that they're doing something with Samoa Joe. I mean, ideally Samoa Joe would be great on his own, you know, as a killer heel or a killer babyface. That's really a role that I think Joe excels in. Once upon a time, he got over a lot in that role against Kurt Angle, so it is doable. It's not like, well, you know, Samoa Joe is only big in Ring of Honor. He can't be a big star on his own outside of ROH. That's bullshit. We've seen him become a big star outside of ROH before. But you know what? They've done nothing with him for so long that to see him on television in any capacity and doing something like this, him and Magnus seem to be gelling together as a team. I like just watching this interview. I just like the interplay between the two of them. This was really cool stuff until Matt Morgan and Crimson came out and ruined the whole thing. So I like that. I made a comment on Twitter, actually, also. There was a commercial that TNA has. Direct Auto Insurance is a sponsor for TNA. And so they have, you know, these Direct Auto commercials filmed with TNA talent. And this one happens to have Matt Morgan. And I commented that this commercial to me was such a ripoff of those old Reebok ads with Terry Tate, office linebacker. You know, they have that one scene of the commercial where Matt Morgan, you know, tackles this guy or spears him or something, and that part of the commercial to me was just such an obvious ripoff of those old Terry Tate ads. And Matt Morgan, you are in fact no Terry Tate. Alex Shelley beat Austin Aries and Doug Williams in a three-way match. Very good match. Again, for the time they were given, I don't even know if this match went a full 5 minutes. When you take three guys like that and the things that they could do, if you gave them 10, 15 minutes and you condense it down into like 4 or 5, it takes it down a couple of notches. But for what it was, I thought this was very good. Then they had the Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff, Garrett Bischoff in-ring segment. This storyline sucks. Garrett Bischoff has a nice look, and I hope he gets over, and I hope he makes a lot of money. But again, this is the case of the promoter, even though he's not really the promoter, but basically Bischoff is, you know, the head guy, for all intents and purposes, in TNA, pushing his son at a time when TNA has a tremendous roster of talent. I just talked about Samoa Joe, even though I like his act with Magnus, he could be doing so much more. And they're spending all of this time trying to get Garrett Bischoff over. And as a fan, I resent that. You know, if I were a bigger TNA fan than I am, I would be very unhappy with this. But here we are, you know, Bischoff trying to get his son over, feuding with his son. Bischoff says all these nasty things about him. It's, you know, just Vince McMahon and Shane McMahon and Stephanie McMahon and all the McMahon dysfunctionality and all that that we've seen over the years. That's exactly what this is supposed to be, just a rehash of all of that. And, it, you know, it doesn't do anything for me. You know, it doesn't matter to me. I don't care about any of this. This is stupid. And I'm not the only one. Apparently the fans in Wembley Arena didn't give a shit either, because of all the different segments on Impact this week, and I talked before about what a lively crowd it was, and everybody seemed to be really into the show, the only time on this taped edition of Impact that it really hit me, like it hits me on SmackDown a lot, that they piped in crowd cheers and they piped in crowd noise, was during this segment, at the parts where Garrett Bischoff should have been cheered. It was painfully obvious to me that those cheers that we were hearing were not legitimate. You could just look at the crowd and see that they weren't clapping, or see that they weren't reacting. They'll react to Hogan, but the parts that they were supposed to react when it came to Garrett, or if Garrett was speaking, that reaction was not there. That reaction was not genuine, and it's because the people don't care. We had a knockouts match on this show, Velvet Sky against Mickie James, and my God, Velvet Sky. It's too bad I don't think WWE would ever allow her on television wearing what she usually wears on Impact, but they're really missing the boat on her. Not that she's a great wrestler, she's not. Although I probably would take Velvet over Kelly Kelly, to be honest with you, but she is a very attractive woman. Very plastic, but that's okay. Very attractive nonetheless. So she beat Mickie in a match that, no joke, had to have gone longer than the last 5 or 6 Divas matches on Raw combined. to me, that was what was most refreshing about this. Not that it was a fantastic women's match. It was fine. Didn't offend me. Nobody got killed or anything. But it went, I don't know how long it went. It went longer than any Divas match I've seen in recent memory. And they actually gave them time. It's not like they walked out to the ring and they immediately had to go home, you know, and end the match, where the entrances are longer than the match itself. This was a fine knockouts match. It served its purpose. They gave them some time. This was very nice to see. I'd like to see this happen more often on Raw, but I won't hold my breath. Main event saw Sting and James Storm beat Bully Ray and Bobby Roode. This was the match where Sting suffered his foot injury. I believe what it ended up being was he tore off the fascia. I talked about that last week. And he did not, in fact, rupture or tear his Achilles tendon, which would have most likely meant the end of Sting's in-ring career. So thankfully, it's not quite that serious. He will be at the Against All Odds pay-per-view this week, and I believe he's a special referee for the match. So Sting is going to be okay. They did a very good job of masking his injury at the end. It was a totally freak thing, too, because I don't know exactly when the injury took place. It was somewhere at the very end when he was turning over Bobby Roode to put him in the Scorpion Deathlock, and it didn't look like he tripped over himself or planted his foot wrong, although I guess that's probably how it happened. You would never have noticed. If you didn't know in advance that this was the show Sting got hurt on that spot, you never would have known. And the camera cut away. They didn't show Sting. Sting obviously whispered something to James Storm after the match. He probably told him, shit, I think I tore my Achilles. But you would never know. And they never made reference to it. And the final shot, I believe, was of Bobby Roode staring down Bully Ray. Two of them are both involved in the pay-per-view main event this weekend, along with James Storm and, I believe, Jeff Hardy. So that is your main event, again, for the few people who actually are going to watch, Against All Odds. But that was it. You know, a fine tag match. Sting pinned Bobby Roode. You can make the argument, how can you have 53 or 54-year-old Sting causing the world champion to submit at the end of the show? But, I guess it worked into the story where Bully Ray kind of left him high and dry. And it plays into, you know, the theme of, I don't trust you, I'm your opponent at the pay-per-view. But still, I would not have had the World Heavyweight Champion tapping out to Sting at the end of the show. But I will not protest too much. This was a very fine episode of Impact. Like I said, Impact was a better show than Raw this week. And there were one or two people making comments about, you know, John Cena was not on Raw. So even when John Cena is not on Raw, people still can't enjoy the show. Listen, I enjoyed the show immensely the week before last. I raved about Raw. I thought the Royal Rumble sucked donkey balls, but I thought Raw was great. Unfortunately, this week I thought the show took a step back. It wasn't a terrible show, but who cares? If John Cena is not on the show, it makes the show better. That doesn't make the show great. If John Cena were on Raw, I probably would have thought that show sucked because they would have shoved him down our throat. The fact that he wasn't on Raw, I thought was a good move, but Impact was just a better wrestling show. A few random notes here to talk about the WWE's Legends House show, which is actually filming as we speak out on the West Coast. The rumor has it that the show may actually debut on the Sci-Fi Channel as early as April 17th, which would be a Tuesday night. So Legends House may be airing as its own show on cable. I believe they're filming 10 episodes of the show. I know Roddy Piper is on the show. Iron Sheik, as it turns out, is on the show. I was under the impression he was not going to be. Stephanie McMahon, I think, made the comment recently in an interview that Sheik would be on the show. I think Sergeant Slaughter, Dusty Rhodes, I don't know the full roster. Honky Tonk Man has denied the reports that he would be on the show. So in due time, we'll find out exactly who's on. I know Mean Gene Okerlund is maybe the hosting. I know he's part of it also. So that'll be cool if it'll be on cable, because obviously their new network is not launching until later this year. And you have to be really careful with a show like this. You're filming a show with legends. I love all of these guys. But if you film the show now and you keep it in the can until, let's say, November, and even November may be optimistic as far as when the new network might launch. Who knows? I mean, it could end up being pushed back to 2013 at this point. A lot of things can happen between now and then. It would be a real shame if, God forbid, one of these legends, you know, Iron Sheik, for example, he's getting a lot older. He's not in good physical condition. If, God forbid, he were to die between now and then, now you've got this show filmed, and I don't know what his role will be on the show. Maybe he'll be an antagonist, he'll be the heel, I don't know. Now he's gone, and you've got this show that hasn't even debuted on television yet. It's kind of a touchy thing, so this is not something they can film now and just cut like an evergreen and keep it in the can and just kind of air it whenever they want to. So putting it on cable, I think, is a good move. Everybody will be able to see it, and if this show turns out to be a hit, they could do future seasons with these guys, with other legends, and put future seasons on the network. I mean, if this show is a big hit, you can have a real hook for your new network when it finally launches. So I like this. Another news here, this actually came from this week's Observer newsletter. There are plans within WWE. I don't know what this means, but there are plans within WWE of changing the way that house shows are done, with the idea of making them more like the television tapings. I do not like this idea. Unlike the Legends House, this idea I do not like. One of the things about house shows that's so great is you actually have an opportunity to go to a house show and see actual wrestling matches. You know, you can get 5, 6, 7 matches on a card, maybe even 8. And a lot of guys get on the show. Usually the matches, the top matches, will get some time. You can see a really good 15-minute wrestling match. And I don't know exactly what this means. When I hear that they want to make them more like TV tapings, it makes me think storylines and promos. Long promos, okay? We don't need long promos eating up time on house shows, okay? I think this is a terrible idea. Maybe they'll try it out and then they'll abandon it. I guess we'll find out. But when I first read this, it just made me shudder. Because one of the things I always liked about going to the house shows was you actually got really good matches, you know, is the fact that it was different from the TV tapings. I've been to a ton of TV tapings in my lifetime. I've been to like 9 different Raw shows at least. And I think 2 SmackDown tapings or something like that. And the fact is, it gets very boring, for example. You take a commercial break, you sit there. You come back from commercial break, now you got a long 15-minute interview segment. Then you get a match. Then you get a bunch of commercials, you get another promo. It can get very boring and very tedious to be in the crowd, but you expect it because it's a television taping. Now you're talking about, again, I don't know exactly what their plans are beyond maybe having more promos on the show and I mean, there's no commercials, obviously, to worry about, but I don't like this. I don't like the sound of this at all. So we'll see if it goes anywhere. That was that seemed to be the big rumor going around this week. Ring Ka King, I mentioned them a little bit earlier. I did a review of their first show on the Sound Off. I believe was it 2 weeks ago, maybe. The ratings for their debut show are in. They did a 2.2 rating, which was good for about 14 million viewers. The show went over an hour. The overrun did about 18 million viewers. And for that network, the Colors Network, on that particular night, apparently that was good. It was not great. But still, TNA got 14 million people to watch one of their wrestling shows. I never thought I'd be able to sit here and say that. So congratulations to TNA. They seem to have hit off on something in India. Not all that surprising. I mean, there's a lot of wrestling fans in India. There's a lot of wrestling fans in India who listen to this podcast. And the population of India has just exploded in recent years. And, you know, the complaints that you hear when they go over there, you know, WWE had this awful tour of India many years ago where a lot of people got sick. It's just, you know, the water supply, the way that food is prepared. Sometimes your system, when you're in a foreign country, you don't know how you're going to react to that. I know people that have gone to Mexico and have stayed away from drinking the water but ate something that perhaps was, you know, that there was water in it. It was made from you know, something that had the water in it, and they were sick for 3 or 4 days straight. I mean, sicker than they've ever been in their lifetime. And that's one of the reasons WWE has been very reluctant to go back there. There were wrestlers who said they would quit the company before they would go back to India. So I was a little surprised when TNA, you know, announced that they were going to be essentially, you know, building a promotion in that country and sending a lot of their talent over there to participate. I haven't heard any major horror stories other than some wrestlers have commented how depressed they are seeing how so impoverished some of the areas in India are and how poor some of the people are. But they've enjoyed their experience working there, and apparently the show is becoming more and more popular. And, you know, again, even for a network where 14 million viewers in that time slot is considered good but not great, like I said, 14 million eyeballs watching a TNA product, that's pretty impressive. And actually, I guess that would be 28 million eyeballs if you have 14 million people. Unless you have people who are like blind in one eye, or maybe they lost one eye in like a tractor accident or something, then maybe it's more like 23 million or something. But anyway, just a quick word here on Ring of Honor. I haven't really talked much lately about ROH, which I do regret. I just haven't had the time to dedicate to it. Sunday, March 4th is the promotion's big 10th anniversary show at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. It's also an iPay-per-view, so you can watch the show online through GoFightLive.com. Main event will see the Ring of Honor champion Davey Richards teaming up with Kyle O'Reilly against Eddie Edwards and Adam Cole. Also, the Briscoes and the Young Bucks will meet for the Ring of Honor tag team titles. Ring of Honor also held a set of TV tapings, and I wanted to make a note here that on the show set to air February 25th, Davey Richards battles Jay Lethal in what should be a hell of a match. For those of you who don't know, I interviewed the Ring of Honor TV champion, Jay Lethal, on Sound Off 187. It was a great interview. We talked about his return to the promotion, his time in TNA, and he opened up about some of the things he didn't like while working there and a bunch of other things. So, cheap plug, if you started listening to this show after episode 187, go back and check that interview out. I think it's a good one that's worth your time. But a lot of good things coming up for Ring of Honor as well. And one of the other things I regret is that Ring of Honor typically will have one or two shows down in, well, in this case, it would be down in Florida around WrestleMania time. They kind of go down there. A lot of wrestling fans are traveling in, as I will be, from out of town. And I'm flying in at such a time where I will not be able to attend any of the Ring of Honor shows, which I kind of regret. But for those of you who are able to do so, it's absolutely worth it. I know last year around WrestleMania, they had some amazing matches. And, yeah, so check it out if you're looking for some great wrestling action. And, again, go back and check out episode 187 for my interview with Jay Lethal. Time for the mailbag. If you have any questions to submit, do so at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I saw one person online mentioning that my email address was solomonster@sescoops.com. Not quite sure where that came from. There is no such email address. All questions should come to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com for any future mailbag questions. Let's start here with a question from Steve. Dear Solomonster, huge fan of your show. Question I have is a little peculiar. I watched the King of the Ring DVD last night, and it featured the HBK Stone Cold match from 1997 when they were tag team champions. In the early seconds of the match, a special Olympian, as JR put him, jumped the barricade. Security gets the kid away from the match, and Michaels realizes what's going on and tries to help the kid out. Austin goes back on the attack, and the match picks up again, but Michaels goes back to the kid and takes him up the ramp, while Austin waits for him to come back for the match. On one hand, it just seems like a run-of-the-mill fan interference, but I feel in this instance, it added to the oil and water dynamic between Michaels and Austin. Essentially, was this planned, or just an unexpected incident that was handled admirably and very well? I asked my friend about this, and he feels it's just an unexpected incident. I'm leaning towards that mindset as well, but it illustrates the dynamic of both wrestlers real well at the same time from the storyline perspective. And I think in that respect, it's just a coincidence. It was not planned. It was not staged. It was a special Olympian, as they referred to him, who was obviously a Shawn Michaels fan, I think, and not a fan of Steve Austin. He tried to get involved. And I think Michaels took umbrage with security. Security was being a little rough, I think, with the kid. And Michaels went over to try to handle the situation. And, you know, the kid's mother came over, and he wanted to make sure the kid got reunited with his mother and all that. And, you know, the second part of Steve's question here on the subject of fan interference, he says, is there a certain instance of fan interference that you enjoy, or does it just make you shake your head in disgust? It makes me shake my head in disgust. I cannot think of an incident where a fan has interfered and it makes me really happy. I mean, there are times when a fan will do something, it'll make me laugh, it'll make me giggle. Usually that happens when I see the fan getting his ass kicked as a result of interfering, when the wrestlers have carte blanche to basically stomp a mud hole in them, and they are well within their right to do so. You know, you can't prosecute them for that. This person is trespassing, he's interfering, you know, in a place where he or she has no business to interfere. These wrestlers, hey, they're just defending themselves. Self-defense. I love it. I mean, if you go back and watch Bash at the Beach 1996, which is actually airing right now on WWE Classics On Demand, there's a lot of good stuff, actually, right now on Classics On Demand. They're showing the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view from 1996. This was the show where Hulk Hogan turned heel and joined the NWO. And at the end of that match, fans are throwing debris into the ring, and Hogan is posing with Hall and Nash. And there's one point where a fan, this fat dude, tries to climb into the ring. Tries to, I think, crawl under the bottom rope, and Scott Hall goes over and stops him and just starts stomping on his head. And I cheered him for that. I thought that was awesome. Because these idiots have no business getting in the ring. You never know if they're going to be armed with something, some sort of chemical or a weapon or something. Plus, they're fucking the show up for everybody else. And, you know, the thing about it that really pisses me off, as I think back to the worst fan interference, at least on a WWE show, that I can recall that could have resulted in tragedy, was that ladder match on Raw back in 2002 with Rob Van Dam and Eddie Guerrero. You know, and there's a part of the match where RVD is down and Eddie is climbing the ladder, and some idiot douchebag, I think in an Oilers jersey or something like that, some bald-headed fool, runs into the ring and shoves the ladder over. Now, Eddie saw this just in the nick of time and kind of jumped off and landed on his feet. But if Eddie didn't see it or didn't have enough time to react, this fool would have pushed the ladder over with Eddie Guerrero on it. So at that point, this fool, he's probably drunk, is throwing his fists up in the air and going, yay! And then he gets tackled by Earl Hebner. How embarrassing to be taken down by Earl fucking Hebner. And then Eddie, of course, who had was known to have a hot temper, and in this case, he was well within his rights to be pissed off about what just happened. I think he kind of went off camera. He went over to kick the guy and stomp the guy a little bit for good measure. I love how the camera goes back to Rob Van Dam. You know, you talk about RVD 420. They go back to RVD on the mat. He's got this look on his face. He's looking up to see what's going on. He looks high as a kite. I mean, I'm not saying he was, but I just thought that was a funny shot to show Rob Van Dam clearly dazed and confused about what was going on. So that instance of fan interference, maybe more than any other one that I can recall off the top of my head, really, really pissed me off. Eddie could have been seriously injured as a result of falling off that ladder. He could have fallen over the ropes into the floor and broken his neck or any other part of his body. There's absolutely no excuse for that. This question comes from Connor in Dublin, Ireland. Always a pleasure to listen to your insightful and forthright opinions on the business. With that in mind, I have two questions. The first regards your favorite all-time ring entrance of WrestleMania. I only started thinking about this when I read an article recently listing John Cena's WrestleMania 23 entrance, driving the Ford Mustang, as the best ever, as if. However, my personal favorite is Shawn Michaels' descent from the rafters prior to his epic battle with The Undertaker at WrestleMania 25. What is your opinion on that? Well, I obviously disagree with WWE.com saying John Cena's WrestleMania 23 entrance was the best. I don't think any of John Cena's entrances were the best. I would honestly, you mentioned Shawn Michaels' descent at WrestleMania 25. I think his descent from the ceiling of the pond in Anaheim for WrestleMania 12, when he came in on that zip line before the Iron Man match with Bret Hart, I think that entrance still stands the test of time. You know, it's one of the more famous clips on their WrestleMania highlight reel. There's a reason for it. It was a pretty amazing entrance. If not that, you mentioned WrestleMania 23. There was something about The Undertaker's entrance. I'm pretty sure it was WrestleMania 23 before his match with Batista. And there's been more, grandiose entrances for The Undertaker at these pay-per-view shows. But if I remember correctly, this was the WrestleMania where there was the white light. It was almost on the side of the entrance. It wasn't from the ceiling. He didn't come up from underground. It was just this white light, and you saw The Undertaker's shadow. You know, and he came forward out of the white light and then walked to the ring. It was actually very basic, but that image, that silhouette of The Undertaker coming out of the white light, I just thought that was really, really cool. Second part of Connor's question here, as a 19-year-old today, I came back to the business in 2005, a year where Batista and John Cena became the top stars on each brand, and also a year which saw the passing of the late, great Eddie Guerrero. I wanted your opinion on this year in WWE with regard to storylines, matches, etc. What did you think of it? 2005, when I think back to that, as far as WWE is concerned, was a big business year for the company. That Triple H Batista main event at WrestleMania 21 did big business for them. In fact, that was probably the last WrestleMania before the Rock show last year to top a million buys. And they didn't have any big celebrities on that show. You know, Rock was going to be on that WrestleMania card. His contract had run out. WWE let Rock's contract run out at the end of 04. He took great offense to that, and that was pretty much it for many years with him in WWE. He did not appear at WrestleMania that year, so they didn't have that one big star, that one big celebrity. They had Stone Cold on Piper's Pit, but, you know, again, it wasn't a match. I don't think most people were buying WrestleMania to see Piper's Pit necessarily. That Triple H Batista main event was built up tremendously. Originally, it was going to be Triple H and Randy Orton, and Batista just got over. I mean, he just got on fire, won the Royal Rumble, had tremendous fan support, and was a fresh face at the top of the card. And that main event with Triple H and Batista did big business. I'll give Triple H a lot of credit for helping make that happen. Big business also they did for SummerSlam that year. They had the big Shawn Michaels Hulk Hogan match. That SummerSlam did well over 500,000 pay-per-view buys, which, I mean, in today's day and age, to have any pay-per-view other than Mania do anything like 500,000 or 600,000 buys would be unfathomable. I mean, that's how far their pay-per-view business has fallen But that match, which, again, they could have done more. They were going to have a second match. I answered this question, by the way, in the SC Scoops mailbag this week. Why was there no rematch between Michaels and Hogan and the politics behind it and everything? So go check out that mailbag from Friday if you missed it. But that match at SummerSlam still did big numbers for them and was one of the few really last remaining dream matches, if you can call it that. And Hulk Hogan is obviously, I mean, he hasn't been in his physical prime for many years, but it was still a big deal for the company. So when I think back to 05, I really think that that was the last year, aside from maybe when Rock came back last year, that they were able to do some big business on their pay-per-views. And as far as the matches and everything, I mean, nothing in particular stands out. Triple H and Batista had some good matches. Chris Jericho and John Cena had a great match, I think, at SummerSlam that year. That was right before Jericho left for his two-year hiatus. But nothing else really in particular jumps out at me. I was a fan of the Rumble that year. For whatever reason, I have not been a big fan of the Royal Rumble matches in recent years, but for whatever reason, 2005 I very much enjoyed. So I think it was a good year in that regard. Actually, let me correct myself now that I think about it. I'm pretty sure the 2007 Mania, with the Battle of the Billionaires and Vince McMahon and Donald Trump, I think that actually did well over a million buys as well. Again, because of the hair gimmick and Trump's celebrity involvement. But aside from that show, I don't believe they've come close to breaking a million until last year because of The Rock. Rory writes in with two questions here. Why is there a difference in the tension of the ropes? Back in the old days, the ropes were very loose, and nowadays they're a lot stiffer. Is this to accommodate for more high flyers? Yes and no. I mean, that's part of it. It would be very difficult for somebody like a Rey Mysterio, for example, to do a 619 if the ropes were really loose and shaky. But also, you know, if you hit the ropes and the ropes are a lot stiffer, you tend to come off with a lot more speed. So it's not just high flyers. I think it helps in that respect as well. What was WWE's reason for joining the New York Stock Exchange and becoming a publicly traded company, and do you think it was a good idea? They wanted to make more money. That's why they did it. Was it a good idea? You know, I don't know. That's up for Vince McMahon to decide. I mean, if they wanted to not have to reveal their financials to the world, obviously it would be a lot better for them to have not gone public. But then again, you know, you have a UFC or a TNA. They're privately owned companies as well. And those sorts of numbers still come out. I mean, they don't have to delve into their financials the way WWE does, though, so there is something. You do give up a lot of that by going public. I suppose if Vince has regrets about that, then it would have been better for them not to. But, you know, aside from that, I don't really know that it's affected the company that much. You could say that they have to answer to their stockholders. Maybe that would be the biggest change. Before, they could pretty much do whatever they wanted to, but I don't really buy that it makes that much of a difference just because, you know, yes, you have to, you know, you want to keep your stockholders happy, but I've said before, it comes down to sponsors, to television sponsors. And at the end of the day, if the company is making money by going more risque and they wanted to return to the Attitude Era, which they won't, and they knew that they could do so and not jeopardize their existing sponsors, but they knew they would make more money, I think they would do it. I think at the end of the day, those sponsors may be more important to Vince McMahon than the stockholders. At least that's the way that they sometimes behave. Believe me, they put a lot of stupid shit on their television shows that would make me think, boy, the stockholders aren't going to stand for this, and somehow there's never been any sort of revolt. So I don't really know that it makes that much of a difference. Jacob writes in, can I see Tony Dreamer in the WWE Hall of Fame one day? I don't know who that is. Ash from Melbourne, Australia writes in. First off, he wants to know if he can get a birthday shout-out. His birthday was on February 5th, so it's a little dated at this point. He says he got a shout-out last year, and it seemed to start the whole trend of birthday shout-outs on your show. Would appreciate another one this year. Well, it's a little too late now, but happy birthday. Hopefully you got everything you wanted and your birthday went well. His question here, now that Zack Ryder's Z True Long Island story is under WWE's banner on YouTube, do I think Zack's show will benefit from this move or will it worsen? I thought I answered this recently, but the one thing the biggest change for me, the show still pretty much looks the same. I watched it yesterday, actually, the one with he goes to Lucasfilms and he's a big Star Wars nerd, I guess. I still have never seen a Star Wars movie in my life. I've seen parts of the first one. I couldn't sit through the whole thing and I'm just not a big Star Wars fan. But the thing I noticed about Zach's show is that comments are still disabled. Somebody said that, well, they enabled comments. No, they didn't. Comments are still disabled. In fact, Zach makes a mention of it in the video itself. Because, you know, Zach, at the end of his show, used to say, leave a comment on my YouTube channel. And now people can't do that. I mean, they can leave a comment on his YouTube channel. But I don't even know if his YouTube channel is still there anymore. The show is under WWE's YouTube channel, and they don't allow comments because, you know, after all, they don't want to hear from the WWE universe, no matter what they may say on television. Obviously, they don't give a shit what you have to say. Maybe they'll change that. I don't know. But to me, that was one of the things when you start disabling comments and taking away people's ability to voice their opinions on what they just watched. And that's when things start to go in a really bad direction and people start to resent you for it. You sold out. You know, the show is not what it used to be, even though the show looks pretty much identical to what it used to be. I think that could be a very big negative going forward. If they don't enable comments on those videos, there's going to be a lot of people, I think, who just don't even bother watching the videos anymore. I really think that they've got to make that change. I don't know if they can implement a thing where they allow comments just for Zach's videos and still keep them disabled for all their other videos. But if they can't, I think that's a big negative for Zach's show. Nissim writes in, WWE has decided to reuse the famous Austin vs. McMahon storyline with Punk and Laurinaitis and isn't doing too badly. Do you think WWE should go boldly to the pages of its history and regurgitate any other storylines? That's all they ever do, is regurgitate storylines. Are you kidding me? I'm actually shocked when they come up with an original idea, and part of it is not even their fault. You know, wrestling has been around for so many years. You almost get to a point where you've done, not all, but most of the key stories that you can do. So them regurgitating certain storylines, I can't even blame them completely for it. It's inevitable that you're going to redo something that you did once before. But, I mean, my God, they do it so often. I mean, even look recently, they did the whole spot. This was a spot, not a storyline, but still the whole ring collapse spot with Mark Henry and Big Show, which they did with Big Show and Brock Lesnar many years ago. You know, they had the Nexus a couple of years ago, which was a regurgitation, I guess, not of their storyline, but somebody else's, which was a carbon copy of the NWO. I mean, give me a break. They recycle storylines all the time. You would think with a whole writing team. I mean, back in the day, you had Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson and maybe one or two other people, and they would come up with what was going to happen. They would come up with the storylines, and everything seemed to be fine. Now they have a whole team. They have like 20-some-odd people writing the shows for them. You would think they'd be able to come up with some original ideas every now and then. David from Northern Ireland writes in, after listening to a recent show where you talked about the 1992 Royal Rumble that Ric Flair won, I was wondering if you knew why Flair was only in the WWF for such a relatively short period. I mean, obviously they pushed him well by letting him win that Rumble and main eventing WrestleMania 8, but he was only there for about a year or two and then went back to WCW. I know that on his DVD he said regarding the first time he was in WWF that it was the greatest year and a half of my career outside the time that I spent with Arn Anderson and the Four Horsemen. Was there ever any particular reason given as to why he left to go back? Did he just miss his friends like Arn and the other Horsemen? Also, why did WCW accept him back so easily after he paraded the big gold belt on WWF television? Were they not upset with him? As far as why Flair left WWF, I think it's pretty well documented that he had an agreement with Vince McMahon. I don't think it was anything in writing. I think it was more of a gentleman's agreement that if the time ever came that he was no longer in a headline position in the company, if the time ever came that he got pushed down the card, that he would be allowed to go back to WCW, which, you know, you think about that now, and it just sounds completely absurd, but, you know, there is truth to it. You know, Vince respected Flair greatly, and you could tell just based on the way Flair was pushed when he was in WWF. You know, Flair didn't show the same toughness as a heel that he showed in WCW. He was more of the prototypical chicken shit heel that you would see back then in WWF. But he came in, you know, with a big gold belt. He was a big star right away. He won the Royal Rumble, looked like $1 million in doing so, became the champion, was in one of the main events at WrestleMania. You know, he didn't even have a match at SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium, but he was still involved in the world title storyline involving the Warrior and the Macho Man. Then he won the belt back. So McMahon treated Flair with a level of respect that he did not show to other people like Dusty Rhodes, who came in and was treated like a complete joke, or even Harley Race. You know, they made Harley Race the king of WWF, but still, it was a joke the way that Harley Race was portrayed compared to the way he was in the NWA back in the day. But yet Flair came in and he became the champion and he was treated like a real star. So there was a respect there that you could tell between McMahon and Flair. And as I said, the agreement was that if the time ever came that Flair was being pushed down the card at all, that he would be allowed to leave. And that's exactly what happened. He could see the writing on the wall. He went to Vince and said, listen, you know, it's obvious that I'm not going to be involved in the world title picture anymore. And I would like to leave and go back to WCW. And Vince allowed him to do that. He had the Loser Leaves Town match on Raw with Mr. Perfect. That was, in fact, not his final match. He did wrestle a few more dates, I believe, on a European tour. It might have been that WWF had at the time. Or maybe it was just some house show dates. But he finished up his dates, and he went back. And I think he went back with the provision that he was not allowed to wrestle, either for a specified period of time, or Vince was going to let him go back to WCW, but maybe it was however much time was left on his contract. He would not be allowed to wrestle until that time had lapsed. Because I know Flair went back to WCW in either February or March is when he came back. As a matter of fact, there's an episode of WCW Worldwide from March of 1993 airing right now on Classics on Demand, which features Flair doing a promo and all the pomp and circumstance. Oh my God, Ric Flair is back. So he came back around that time. He was hosting this talk show segment called The Flair for the Gold. He didn't wrestle. I don't believe he wrestled at all until the match with Vader at Starrcade at the end of the year. So it was many, many months he was not allowed to wrestle. But, yeah, Vince let him go back. And Vince kept his word. There was some level of respect there that very rare, even back then, let alone today, would Vince McMahon or any promoter, I think, allow a top star like that to do something like that or have some sort of agreement where, when I'm not pushing you as a top guy anymore, I'll let you go back to the competition. That just didn't happen. But in Flair's case, he was extended that courtesy by Vince McMahon. As far as WCW taking him back, WCW loved having Ric Flair back. WCW jumped at the opportunity to take Ric Flair back. When Ric Flair left WCW, it was over a disagreement with Jim Herd, who had no business running WCW. I think he was a pizza executive who was brought in to basically run the company, didn't know a goddamn thing about wrestling. Wanted Ric Flair to cut his hair. He was going to give him this Spartacus character. Flair decided, fuck you, I'm leaving. And there was a lot of bad blood and animosity there. And you can make the argument that Flair doing what he did by agreeing to, calling Vince McMahon and saying, hey, I got this belt. You know, you want to do something with it. You can make the argument that was a really shitty thing for Ric Flair to do. You know, he had a lot of friends that still worked in WCW, and you know, here you are parading the belt that they associate with that company on the competition's programming. In a lot of ways, that was a really dumb thing for Flair to do, but so maybe there were still people that held a grudge. It's still, I'm not saying everybody welcomed Flair back with open arms, but by the time Flair went back, I'm pretty sure Jim Herd was gone. And Bill Watts may have actually been in power at that point in WCW. Either Bill Watts or Kip Fry. I don't know who it would have been, but I think Jim Herd was gone, I think, by that point. So that animosity was kind of washed away, and Flair wanted to go back home, you know, where he made his name, and he was comfortable there, had a lot of friends who still worked there. So, believe me, WCW was not going to deny Ric Flair the opportunity to come back. He was still the biggest star that they could possibly have, and he came back, and, you know, obviously he did some big things. I mean, that match with Vader at Starrcade at the end of 93, boy, you look back on that now, that would have been such a great bookend to Ric Flair's career, if he would have decided to hang up the tights and retire after that. I mean, that championship win over Vader, I think it was in the Carolinas. I mean, it was so great. And Flair, by that point, was already being looked at as this washed-up guy. When's he going to quit? And this was 1993. Had Flair actually retired back then, man, that would have been a hell of a way to end your career. But then again, you know, Flair never would have gotten that great send-off he got in 2008, even though he ended up coming back and kind of, fucking all that up anyway. So, Fiergas Kelly writes in, a loyal iTunes reviewer, he says, I recently had a friend tell me that the Chris Benoit tribute show on Raw was the most distasteful thing he had ever seen, considering the circumstances in which he died. Safe to say he retracted that statement after a cold, hard dose of fact. It got me thinking, though, in your own experience, what is the most universally disrespectful and distasteful thing you've seen in professional wrestling? Apart, of course, from Katie Vick. Ah, you took away my answer. But, you know, there's been a lot of really disrespectful things. In particular, I recall back in 2006, the whole Eddie is dead thing with Rey Mysterio and Randy Orton. That was really disrespectful. But honestly, one thing that jumps out at me is the interview that Vince McMahon did on Raw with Melanie Pillman, the night after Brian Pillman died. Pillman died the morning of an In Your House pay-per-view. And Vince went on the air before the pay-per-view to announce what had happened. This was not part of a storyline. He was found dead in his hotel room. And there was a lot of raw emotion. Brian Pillman was a friend to many, and it was a big shock to the wrestling community when he died. Having his widow live on TV the next night for an interview, you know, putting her on TV, and I don't know whose idea that was, if Melanie Pillman actually went to Vince and said, let me come on Raw. I don't think that's what happened. Even if it did, you've got to have some common sense here. I mean, you're putting this woman on television, you're asking her all these different questions, she's crying. I mean, even back then, I was a lot younger, but it was very uncomfortable to watch, and it made me wonder, why am I watching this? Why is this even... When else in WWF history have they ever... And believe me, there's been a lot of people who have died. You know, when have they ever had the widow of that person on their television show for an interview? They've never done it again for a good reason, because there was a lot of backlash, and they realized, boy, this was something that we really should not have done. So I look back on that now, and I actually watched that recently. I was watching, I think, the Brian Pillman 10 Bell Salute tribute on Raw, and then I watched the interview with Melanie, and it's just awful stuff. There was no reason to put that on television. It was so obviously done for ratings. Don't give me any bullshit. Oh, well, it wasn't done for ratings. It was the only reason that was done was to pop a fucking rating. And if the only reason you're putting this guy's widow on television is to pop a fucking rating, I defy you to find me something more vile than that. Steven from Atlanta, Georgia writes in, longtime listener since episode one, first time writing in. I have a question here for you regarding Steve Austin. I remember on a podcast a while back, you said that Austin was due to win the WWF title at the Final Four pay-per-view back in 97, but was changed because of an injury. My question is, how much do you think things would have been different for Austin himself had this happened? Would he have taken off as he did later after WrestleMania 14? Would it become a meaningless title win, seeing as how he might have lost it to Bret at WrestleMania 13? Anyway, there's no way of knowing for sure. I think Austin would have been fine. His career path may have been a little bit different, but at the end of the day, he would have gotten over. The fans would have taken to him. They would have done big business. And you know what? Who knows? Because maybe if that happened, if he won the title earlier in the year, it changes the course of his career a little bit. Maybe he doesn't have that SummerSlam match with Owen Hart and doesn't get dropped on his head, therefore suffering a neck injury. And even with the surgery that he had, the neck injury is the real reason he was forced out of wrestling so early. And he had to take that year off, which gave Rock and Triple H an opportunity to elevate their game and become bigger stars. And Austin didn't come back, as I said, went heel, then he went face, and then he had to leave because he was having neck problems. It's one of those what-if questions we'll never know the answer to. I think back to when Austin cut that promo with the King of the Ring in 96. You know, Austin won the King of the Ring tournament in June of 1996. He cut the Austin 316 promo. And 2 months later at SummerSlam, he wasn't even on the pay-per-view. He had a match, like a three-minute match, if that, with Yokozuna on the pre-show, on the free-for-all. The only reason he won was because Yokozuna was so fat, they did this gimmick where he was climbing up for the Banzai Splash and was holding onto the rope and yanked the rope out of the turnbuckle and fell over, and Austin pinned him. That's what Austin was doing 2 months after he won King of the Ring. Can you imagine if Steve Austin won the tournament and got a title match with Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam that year in 1996? First of all, what an awesome match that would have been. You know, instead of Michaels and Vader and Austin on the pre-show, to have Austin versus Michaels for the championship in the main event of SummerSlam 1996, when both guys were arguably at their physical peak. I mean, Austin as a wrestler back in 1996, he was so much quicker. He would do things that you would never see the 1998 Steve Austin do, in part because physically he was not what he used to be. And Michaels, obviously, later, his back caused him a lot of issues and all that. So to see Austin versus Michaels back in 1996 as opposed to their first singles match, which I think was at the King of the Ring in 97, I don't think they had a match before that. Maybe they did on Raw. It is possible they had a Raw match once, but that would have been a kick-ass main event at SummerSlam that year. And you know, if you gave Austin the title back then, I mean, again, it opens up this whole kind of Pandora's box of questions that we'll never know the answer to. Kenneth writes in with more of a statement than a question. I cannot stand Triple H, he says. I find his matches to be pretty boring overall. He's buried talent, said Foley wasn't tough, got Bret screwed, leeched off many factions and groups, and just recently put his buddy Sheamus over on the Rumble over Chris Jericho, someone else that he also seems to dislike. Now I'm starting to believe that the only reason that Triple H wants to wrestle The Undertaker one more time is that he doesn't want to put over any talent. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe Triple H is the greatest ever, but I can't stand that asshole. Wow. That comes from Kenneth. I wish he would really let us all know how he really feels about Triple H. Jesse from Arlington, Texas writes in, big fan since episode 88. February 9th was my 20th birthday. Wanted to share it on the sound off. Happy birthday. What do you think of the non-PG sexual innuendo jokes on SmackDown involving Oksana and Teddy Long? Just wanted to hear your opinion since you haven't touched upon it. Keep on doing the show. Look forward to it each week. Makes it go by that much faster. I haven't seen all of the Oksana Teddy Long segments. I've seen some of them. I saw the one on SmackDown this week. You know, they got the blue light in the background, and then Daniel Bryan walked in, and then all of a sudden the blue light disappears. And when they do stuff like that, I hate it just because it makes it seem so fake. But as far as the non-PG kind of sexual aspect of it, I think it's kind of funny, I guess, as long as they don't go overboard with it. I don't know what else you do, quite frankly, with Oksana. You know, she's pretty to look at, but I don't know that I would put her in the same camp as somebody like Maryse, who could really take off as this great heel character, like a heel valet for somebody. I guess it's possible, but maybe this is all that she's really good at. You know, the girl is really good at making out with older men. I don't know. Casey Collins writes in. He's been a big fan since November of 2010, member of the Fantastic Four, wondering if I can get a birthday shout-out. I'm turning 15 on February 13th. Well, happy birthday, Casey. He says, have you ever seen somebody avoid taking a bump like how The Miz dodged R-Truth? Cowardly thing he did there, he says. Honestly, I haven't. I haven't really seen anybody who seemingly, just watching it on TV, seemingly, intentionally tried to get out of harm's way during a bump the way that Miz did on Monday night. I've seen people maybe who were out of position, who couldn't make it in time, or who tripped over themselves, or what have you. But no, I've never seen anything like that before, which I think is why it pissed me off so much. Sean from Chester, England writes in, he too has a birthday coming up on Monday, February 13th. Wanted to know if he can get a birthday shout-out. Happy birthday, Sean. I think what I'm going to do from now on is kind of go through everything in advance, make a list of all the birthdays, and I'll just kind of tackle them all at once. A lot of people who have birthdays this month. A lot of parents getting busy in the month of May, apparently. Anyway, Sean was 4 years old when he witnessed the classic Bret Hart British Bulldog match, and to this day is still one of the best matches I've seen live. I've also seen a great little match between Stone Cold and The Rock when the WWF was back touring the UK after WrestleMania 15, and also the one-hour match between John Cena and Shawn Michaels on Raw from the UK. What is the best match you've seen live? That is a great question. I've been to a few pay-per-views. I've never been to a WrestleMania. Obviously, I'll be to WrestleMania this year. I was at the Royal Rumble in 2008. There was no match on that show that was particularly great. I was at the final Great American Bash show. There was a pretty good Shawn Michaels-Chris Jericho match on that show. There was no terribly great matches at the Fatal 4-Way show that I was at. Survivor Series at MSG was a fun show, but nothing great. I would have to go back to a SmackDown taping that I was at back in February of 2001. It was right around Valentine's. Actually, it might have been February 13th, 2001. Let me go check right now, actually. If February 13th of 01 was a Tuesday, then that would have been a SmackDown taping, and that would have been the show that I was at. Let's find out right now. February 13th, there you go, 2001. That was a Tuesday. I was at a SmackDown taping at, I believe, Nassau Coliseum that night. There was a double main event. Stone Cold against Chris Benoit was the main event of Hour 1, and then Triple H and The Rock was the main event of Hour 2. And I remember that Austin versus Benoit match was a damn good match. So I think the Austin versus Benoit match back in 01 at the SmackDown taping might have been the best match I've ever seen live. Kerry from Stamford, Connecticut writes in, I wanted to say I'm a big fan and enjoy your takes on the current product, and my wife is a big fan as well. What do you think about having Wade Barrett challenge The Undertaker at WrestleMania? Obviously, they had the Nexus attack Undertaker way back when. He never finished his greater purpose. I can see him cutting a promo saying that he's not chasing belts, he's chasing immortality. What do you think of this idea? I've said before, I don't like the idea of Wade Barrett and The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Maybe they could have a good match. Maybe it would give Wade Barrett some rub that he could benefit from. But Undertaker has reached a point now where, new blood or not, it has to feel like a big match. Undertaker Triple H, I will say this much, it feels like a much bigger match than would Barrett and The Undertaker. And, you know, with having Shawn Michaels in there, if that's the way they're going to go and making Michaels the referee, and then, you know, the question is Michaels going to screw The Undertaker, who, of course, beat Michaels twice at WrestleMania and help his best friend, or would Michaels actually cost his best friend his career? The rumor has been that Triple H is going to put his career on the line in this match. I think that dynamic makes the match feel special, even though I have no interest in seeing a third installment of Triple H Undertaker at WrestleMania. Undertaker Barrett is just not a match. It didn't excite me back then. It doesn't excite me now. I'd rather see Undertaker and Sheamus. If you want some really fresh blood to battle The Undertaker at WrestleMania, I've said this before. I think Sheamus would be a good opponent for The Undertaker. I think I would have had Sheamus win the Royal Rumble and say exactly what you're saying. I'm not chasing belts. I'm chasing immortality. Look, I'm going to forego an opportunity at the World Heavyweight Championship, and instead, by winning the Rumble, I would like to have earned myself a right to face The Undertaker instead. Makes the streak feel even bigger. And I think Sheamus and Undertaker, it's face versus face instead of face versus heel, but so is Undertaker Triple H. Face versus face works just fine. My other idea of having John Cena against The Undertaker would also be babyface versus babyface. I would rather have babyface John Cena than heel John Cena face The Undertaker. I think that's what makes the dynamic of that match so special. But Wade Barrett, all due respect to Wade Barrett, I love Wade Barrett. He's a great talker. I think as a wrestler, he's fine. I think he'll be a future world champion at some point. Barrett, Undertaker, or WrestleMania underwhelms me. It's not a match I want to see. Alexander writes into the Sound Off, Dear Solomonster, I have been a fan of the show since episode 190, and episode 205 completes 15 weeks since the first time I heard it and changed the way that I watch wrestling since then. I was wondering if this has ever occurred, if the winner of a match has actually changed in the middle of it. Have you ever heard of such a thing? In fact, I have. And it's been mentioned on this show before. I mentioned earlier my interview with Jay Lethal from 187, but you can go back and listen to episode 182 as well. I did an interview with George Napolitano, a great wrestling historian, photographer, author, just a fascinating guy to listen to. He's been around for a million years, and I don't mean to date him and make him look old, but he told the story on this show. I actually brought it up. He was in Puerto Rico many years ago when Ric Flair was the NWA champion. And he was defending the... Actually, I'm sorry, it wasn't Puerto Rico. It was in the Dominican Republic, I believe. And he was defending the NWA title against Jack Veneno, who was a native of the Dominican Republic. And the environment down there was such that Flair was scared for his life. I mean, back then, people took this very seriously. He was the champion, the heel, coming in. And Flair was supposed to go over in that match. And Flair could see that if I win this match and this guy loses, my life may be over. I may not be able to make it out of this building alive. So Flair actually told, I think he told the referee, I mean, George told the story on episode 182. Flair basically said, listen, he pulled Veneno on top of himself and said, pin me. And Veneno pinned him, and it was an NWA title change that I believe years later was finally acknowledged, because again, he was not supposed to win the championship here, but Flair, for his own well-being, felt that he had to lose. He had to at least give the perception that Jack Veneno had just beaten him for the NWA title so he can slip out unscathed. So there's one great story there going back many years of an instance where somebody was supposed to win the match, and for whatever reason, midway through the match or at some point during the match, that outcome changed. You can go back and listen to episode 182 for some more interesting stories. George was a great guest, so there's your answer. Last email here comes from Matt. He's watching Are You Serious on WWE's YouTube channel. He says, I've realized that Road Dogg and Josh Matthews are a better announced team than Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole. Then again, me and you probably could be a better announced team than Lawler and Cole. I have no doubt about that at all. I think myself and anybody who listens to this show would be a more entertaining announced team than Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole. Anyway, that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. If you have questions, comments, or the like, you can email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter for more live blogging. You never know when I might do that. That's twitter.com/solomonster. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes. And again, leave a review. We're almost at 50 reviews. You could be the 50th review in iTunes, and that will get you a shout-out here on the show. So if you haven't left some love for the show on there yet, go ahead and do so. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. My username on there is TheSolomonster, all one word, no underscore, no space. You can subscribe on there. Anytime there's a new video or a new vintage sound-off, I may be putting up, I'm thinking of putting up episode 3 of the sound-off next on YouTube. I don't know when, so don't ask me, but when it goes up, if you are a subscriber, you'll be the first to know, so hit me up on there. That's going to do it for this week. Next weekend brings episode 206, and we'll have thoughts on Raw. I don't know if I'll watch Impact again. I know Impact is back in the Impact zone this week. They won't have that great UK crowd, aside from the idiots who are chanting what. But if I find time to watch Impact again, I might just do that. And all the latest breaking wrestling news that you could read about on SEScoops.com. We'll talk about that and a whole lot more right here next weekend on The Sound Off. Thank you, as always, for your support. Until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.